Welcome back to the Love in Dubai Show podcast. Thank you so much, as always, for tuning in. We spoke about the UN ceasefire vote, Karen Wazin, the latest on the abortion laws, and an unsung hero.
If you are not subscribed to our podcast, go subscribe right now to the Love in Dubai Show podcast, wherever you get your podcasts from. Enjoy the show.
Good morning, Dubai. Welcome back to the Love in Dubai show, where we go through the top trending stories that everyone across the country is talking about. Our top story today, the UAE voices disappointment over the failed ceasefire Gaza vote.
As well, Dubai influencer Karen Wazin joins Jordanian hit series Fatayat al-Rawabi.
The UAE eases up its abortion laws.
As well, a Sharjah woman mourns her housekeeper and hails her as an unsung hero.
And later on in the show, we are so excited to meet the Oscar-nominated and BAFTA award-winning filmmaker Farah Nabulsi, an advocate for Palestinian rights, as she takes us down her journey of filmmaking and shaping narratives while amplifying voices. We are so excited for this.
Yes, we are. So, but before that, I want to talk to you about something, Casey. Dating apps. There's a dating app that allows you to see or match actually with someone else depending on their credit score.
But we don't have a credit score here, so it's in the States. Mm-hmm. And it's dividing opinion because you need to hit a certain rating before you can get onto the app. But it brings up the question of, do you want to be talking finances before you even start dating, or should that not come later?
That should come later, but then at the same time, I feel like if two people get into a relationship and they do not have their life figured out financially and on other so many other levels, then I don't think that it would work, because it's more than love at this point. That's what I think.
I get it, and it's nice that I get it. But if you're talking finance at that point, like, what's more important? Finances or family? So surely, if you're going to be like, okay, this is what I'm making. I have, you know, paid all my bills my whole life. Therefore, my credit score is fair. If you're putting that out there at the beginning, is that saying that that's more important than the family part? Like, should you not be like, I want this many kids. I want to be married by now. Like, should you not be stating those things as well?
Which is
more important?
I don't think so, because when you first start dating a person, you don't think immediately of marrying them. You know what I mean? Initially,
fine, but this is going down the the stability for future conversation.
Yeah, that is true. But then at the same time, when you're dating, you know, you guys are going to eventually live together. You know what I mean? And you guys are eventually going to be together and so on. And that's when finances do actually kick in at this point. And
money matters.
Money does matter. And as, let's say, a couple actually, usually they disregard that because they're so driven or they're so deep into the love and emotions and all of these things that you often tend to disregard that and forget about that 100%.
Yeah,
and then
true.
And then it's like, 6 months later, you figure out your partner is... You're paying for your partner.
You're paying for your partner.
You are.
But I like that it works both ways.
Yeah,
right? Because
course.
It's like, fine, maybe... you both have to be earning this solid credit score to get yourself onto the app. So it's like women meeting men on an equal level in terms of finances, which I think is cool. Just a quick, anyone watching on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, TikTok now, would you join this dating app? It's available in the States. You have to meet a credit score, which you don't have here, but it basically means you have to, if you've got a mortgage, you have to be making repayments. You can't miss repayments. Your credit card... you can't be missing credit cards. I don't know if I'd even get on this.
That is true.
I don't know if I'd make the cut.
That is true, because then, you know what? Imagine, you're with this person, and this person just, catfished you financially. You know, there's, the catfish term is not only used for, the face and the body and the outside features, but sometimes it can be from the inside.
Financial catfish.
Exactly.
Which could happen
catfish.
Here with your
yes.
Lamborghini photos.
Yes, 100%. You know, because you can just the person can be like, initially they're going to get you gifts, right? Initially they're going to be taking you out on dates. And you're going to have the idea that, oh my God, they are financially stable. But then once you get in and you're dove deep and you're falling in love to the point where you just can't get out, it's not easy to get out of the relationship, you're gonna figure out, imagine like, oh, I have this debt and I have this debt and I have this debt and I need you to help me, and then you're now stuck on the debt with your person.
So true. And it could come from the other side because, you know, that's, you know, as women, we could potentially be financially catfishing men. You know, you're walking around with your designer handbag, got it from Karama. You know, you're always looking super glam. But at the end of the day, it's like, oh, well, this doesn't pay for itself, honey. Here are the bills that come. So that's, women essentially could catfish men. Men could catfish women financially. I love that financial catfish phrase. So therefore, this would put a stop to that.
Yeah.
And it means that you're on a level playing field. But I just question that if you're bringing finances in at the beginning, why not just put it all out there? You know what I mean?
I mean, at the beginning, maybe that would be, I don't know, like it depends from a person to another. You know what I mean? Because again, at the beginning, everything, the other person just wants to seem perfect. You know, the other person is going to be putting on their best image of like, hey, I'm perfect. I'm not going to fight with you. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to buy all of these things. And this is all talk. But do you really know? You don't know. I think it takes like 3 months, which is, by the way, it's been all over TikTok, the 3 months rule.
It takes 3 months to know someone?
Technically, the rule goes as follows. For the first month, you will figure out if the person really likes you. For the second month, it will be very obvious if the person is actually willing to put the effort. For the third month, apparently, it shows if the person is willing to commit to you or not. Which is, by the way, true. In a way, it's true. Because, like, how long can you be pretending for? You know what I mean? Like, 3 months, say.
The cracks start to show after 3 months,
exactly,
guys.
Exactly, 100%. And as well, like, financially, you know, since we're talking about financial catfish people who catfish you financially, technically, as well, like, you know, like, after 3 months, it's just going to show.
I like that. Guys, it's 8:42. Good morning to everyone tuning in across YouTube, TikTok, Twitter, Instagram. We also go live in podcasts. So good morning to our listeners. It is day 139 since the genocide began in Gaza. And according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health in the Gaza Strip, the death toll has risen to 29,195, while 69,170 have been injured and more than 1.9 million people have been displaced from their homes. And this leads us in to our top story of the morning. The UAE voices disappointment over failed ceasefire Gaza vote. The UAE has released a statement regarding the UN Security Council's vote, which was based on the Gaza ceasefire solution.
The tweet reads that the UAE is deeply disappointed with the outcome of today's vote in the UN Security Council of the Human Rights Ceasefire Draft Resolution, which was supported by 13 of the 15 members. After more than 4 months of carnage and no end in sight, this war must end.
13 of 15 members supported this vote, and yet it will not go through. Why? The US has once again vetoed the vote, which is clearly widely supported by Arab countries. The vote also saw the United Kingdom abstaining.
As well, member states and people around the world fear a catastrophe awaiting in Rafah, as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu proposed evacuation of civilians and relocation of Israelis' military offensive to the area bordering Egypt, where Hamas fighters are believed to be hiding.
This is a move that could affect 1.5 million Palestinians seeking refuge there. A strong tweet from the UAE once again saying that this must end. It's been 4 months with no end in sight. And I think the big fear now is everyone is all eyes on Rafah. So many people seeking refuge there. And we hope to God a ceasefire resolution can come quickly.
It is very sad. And as you said, we just hope that a ceasefire is set to happen because it's about time. It's about time. So, you guys, now let's jump to our next story. The UAE eases up its abortion laws. A landmark amendment to the UAE law prioritizes the health and well-being of pregnant women by easing consent rules for abortions in critical situations. Previously, spousal consent was required, but now only the woman's consent holds weight in emergency cases where immediate intervention is necessary to save her life.
the prioritization of female autonomy marks a significant step forward in recognizing women's rights and their agency over their own bodies. Additionally, the restriction limiting abortions to 120 days for cases endangering the mother's life has also been removed, offering greater flexibility and responsiveness to individual circumstances.
The legal framework now empowers the cabinet to determine other permissible abortion scenarios, demonstrating the UAE's commitment to evolving standards and cultural diversity. This is amazing at this point, because, like, you know, we have known that abortion in the UAE was very illegal for a very long time, or required as well as spousal approval. And now the fact that, you know, like, it's just like a, I would say it's wider, and it's like on so many levels allowing abortion, of course, not just like any abortion, you know, like, you know, now a woman, if it creates harm on her health, and so many other as well, like, rules to that, she can just, like, go move forward with the abortion for sure.
Yeah, so it's a small amendment. It was announced a couple of months ago, and there is a legal framework behind this. So the consent rules now lie with the woman in critical situations. So we like to see this law as it continues to evolve in the woman's favor and her right to choose.
100%. And now, to a lighter story, Dubai influencer Karen Wazen joins Jordanian hit series Fatayat al-Rawabi. Lebanese star Karen Wazen recently surprised fans with a brief yet impactful appearance in season 2 of Al-Rawabi School for Girls.
So Karen recently surprised fans with a brief yet impactful appearance in season 2 of the hit Netflix show as she announced her debut via a post on Instagram stories. Not that we needed it. We've got so many big fans of the show here in the office. They knew already. We knew, Karen. We saw it.
As well, now this season, Al-Rawabi School for Girls is all about shedding light on the heavy stuff. It delves into the issue of bullying in schools and the societal pressures faced by young women, specifically in the Arab world.
Which is why it's having such a deep impact. I'll be honest, I hadn't heard of it for season one. Mm-hmm. It was actually yesterday that I noticed it on Netflix, and maybe it's because of the revolving conversation around it. But it was that you saw season one, so many people were super excited for season two, and it hits on important topical things that we don't really see brought to light in the entertainment industry. Is that right?
100%, because in season one, what happened is Layan, who is, you know, like, she is...
No spoilers, she Farah. Is, no
fine,
spoilers,
I'm not
going to
spoil it for you guys. Just watch it. But it was disappointing, honestly. I was disappointed because I loved season one and I didn't want it to go that way for season two. But I understand that season two just wanted to shed light on a lot of themes, including, by the way, as well, body self-image issues, you know what I mean? Binge eating, how a woman should be, how a woman should talk, you know, because, like, it is, by the way, in the Arab region and the Arab world, an Arab girl is always told ayib, which is that it's shameful. Don't say that word. Don't talk like that. Don't laugh like that. Don't do this. Don't do that. And then if in the Arab world as well, if a girl is seen with a guy, that's to the man, to the father or to the brother or even to her cousins, it's like, oh my God, she has hurt my honor. You know what I mean? Mm. Season two sheds light on that, which is why they technically, initially, there is a scene for Layan. But of course, as well, like with the new cast members, like, they shed light on, like, other things as well.
So it's a hit documentary on Netflix. They've started season two. And I think someone like Karen Wazen, who is, you know, super well known across the region, adding her voice to these important causes just kind of amplifies the messaging of the show, which I think is amazing. You guys can watch it on Netflix now, if you'd like, after the show.
Yes.
Let's jump into our next story. A Sharjah woman mourns her housekeeper and hails her as an unsung hero. This is a sad story, but also an important one. Sharjah resident Aruni T on X shared a heartfelt tweet about her former housekeeper who left her homeland and loved ones to make a living and support her family in Sharjah. She highlighted that her housekeeper joined her family in the 80s as a single mom. She began her career as a housemaid, but was promoted to housekeeper for her loyal service.
The tweet goes on to praise the many Sri Lankans whose work goes unpraised and the many migrants who leave their homelands for their loved ones so they can make a good living.
Story we know so well. By doing that, and this is obviously recognizing people in the Sri Lankan community, but you know that will go back to contributing towards Sri Lankan economy. So even when people leave, they are still still adding to the economy and also just sending money back home to the loved ones. The tweet was summarized saying, you know, these are the people that we should be praising. So it's with sadness that we share the story of her death, but also it's a tweet and as a reminder to praise the unsung heroes. We talk about people, committed workers in this country who helped build the country. You know, however, it's not just the work that they're doing here that we should remember. It's the decision that each and every single person made to leave their family at home, essentially to give them a better life. And I've had conversations, for example, with like taxi drivers who, you know, they'll show you photos of their homes that they've built. They'll tell you about their kids that are going to university. And they'll recognize the fact that they've chose a hard life, 6 to 7 working days per week, 11, 12 hour days.
That's true.
Because they've made that decision to support their family. And that's the amazing thing about the work that they do, as long as as well as facilitating the city, but also the lives that they're giving to their family back home. And this is just one unsung hero that we're remembering today.
100%. The fact that, because you know what happens is we often do not recognize that housekeepers, drivers, and people in general just like left their home, left their family, left their whole world back home, and they're just like living in this, I would say, they just in the unknown, and they probably, of course, miss their families, and they're doing all of these things for their families because they want to send back home money to their families. So we tend to forget that, and maybe some people do tend to are kind of like mean in a way. So we forget to be nice and just like be kind and just like gentle with them. And this is beautiful, the fact that this lady recognized the housekeeper that worked at her house for so long. She recognized her efforts and just her power. It's just beautiful.
And it is sad, of course, that it comes with her passing. And I think that, you know, when someone has devoted 40 years to your family, it comes with that kind of, you know, like if they are part of the family as well. And then it's a, you want to give them the praise. And but then you're also recognizing the fact that they left their family. So it's it is one of those kind of difficult, less talked about situations that I'm sure people are more keenly aware if you've been here for 30, 40 years. But today recognizes the unsung heroes. Speaking of unsung heroes, it's 8:52, which brings us to our next guest. We're going to sit down with Farah Nabulsi, the filmmaker and advocate for Palestinian rights, talking about how she sheds light and amplifies voices for the region. Hey guys, welcome back to the Love in Dubai show. We're honored to welcome a filmmaker and advocate for Palestinian rights. Her latest release, The Teacher, is out now. She's Oscar nominated, BAFTA award winning. Stay tuned as we explore the power of film in giving voice to the silenced. Welcome to the show, Farah Nabousi. We're so excited to have you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. So I want to ask, what inspired you initially to become a filmmaker?
Oh, I guess the short version of the story is that I went home. So I'm a Palestinian by blood, by heritage on both my parents' side, but I was born, raised, educated in the UK in London. And so I went to Palestine for the first time as an adult not too long ago, around 8-9 years ago. And it changed me. It changed me witnessing firsthand on the ground what's taking place there. The discrimination, the injustice, and how systematic and institutionalized it is, despite having known what was happening prior to going. But when you see something like that with your own eyes, it has an impact on you that you can't kind of look away from. And so I came back to what I consider my life of privilege, and I'd been writing therapeutically about what I had seen and felt and witnessed and talked about with dozens and dozens of Palestinians. And then a couple of years later, I realized that I could do something with those writings. I kind of felt a desire to sort of express myself creatively about those stories I'd come across, and jumped into the deep end, because I have no formal background in film, studying film. I actually have a financial investment banking background. And few short films later, after producing writing, I directed my first film, The Present, Al Hadiya, which I think you mentioned, and that's available on Netflix. And that was my first film that I directed. Turns out I have the bug and maybe a little bit of talent, I don't know. and never looked back, so yeah.
It's so interesting, you said you visited Palestine for the first time 8 or 9 years ago, and you were surprised by what you saw, and I think we as a people generally potentially become desensitized by what we're seeing. We're seeing so much of it. So when you visited for the first time, what shook you that you didn't know before? What were some key things that kind of stood out to you that you think the world needed to see?
I mean, it's not that I didn't know. It's more that exactly that. It was more the shock and realization, the extent, how colossal the injustice is. Whether it was the sort of the war plowing between Palestinian homes and villages and towns, or the checkpoints, or the very idea of actually sitting with a family on the rubble of their demolished homes versus hearing about that just as numbers, standing in an olive grove where all the trees have been burnt by illegal settlers. It really, and as you're driving through the West Bank, this, and you look up on the hilltops and you see these settlements, that makes it very real, rather than looking at a map, for example. So it's not that I didn't know, it was more the experience of being there on the ground. And I thought to myself, okay, at some point, I'd love people to be able to come to Palestine and see with their eyes as well. That's not very practical, not very logistically possible, mm-hmm. and extremely expensive. So, and you need people to be willing to go. So I guess in some ways the next best thing would be bring Palestine to them. And for me, cinema is one of the most powerful, beautiful means of meaningful human communication and art forms the world has ever known. So if I could do that, then at least we can all kind of witness and feel. Because you said desensitized, right? And that's true. When you get numbers and when you get the sort of facts and figures and you see just images, but doesn't make it real for you. And interestingly enough, someone who just saw my most recent film was telling me they were chatting with someone who came out the cinemas who didn't know so much about what was going on, but did know from a factual perspective. And they had a conversation, complete stranger. And he said, I knew, but actually watching this film made it real. So
interesting.
That's amazing, because you just portrayed what happens in Palestine through your eyes to the people. So you must have faced some challenges while doing the film. What are some of the challenges that you have faced as you were trying to, let's say, portray what's happening in Palestine?
Well, so I shot The Present in the Bethlehem area of the West Bank in Palestine, and then The Teacher, which is a feature-length film, so as a two-hour movie, it's a lot longer on the ground. And I shot that in the Nablus area of the West Bank in Palestine. So already making independent cinema is really hard, no matter where you are in the world, logistically, practically, you're putting out fires every single day. And when you're then actually also shooting in what is militarily occupied, colonized territory, you have that to contend with every single day as well. They say choose the path of least resistance. Maybe we should have shot somewhere else. But honestly, I really wanted to be on the ground from a authenticity point of view, but also from, you know, working with the people there, and there's a lot of talent, but they don't have as much opportunity to work on films and cinema. And anyway, various reasons for doing it there. Now you have that to deal with. And so the challenges for me, while there are practical issues like roadblocks and checkpoints, and so, for example, we had 2 days off and everybody couldn't make it back to set for 4 days because the military had set up roadblocks. You know, that in independent cinema, that's a disaster. But for me, it was more the sort of emotional, mental toll. Because you are, stay with me a second here, but you're basically, you're making a film that's set in a really harsh reality, and you're shooting that film in that harsh reality while that reality is unfolding around you in real time. So an example of this is we were shooting the scene in the film that, I don't want to do spoilers, but anyway, something's happening in that. And meanwhile, in the village of Barine, which is a village very nearby where we were shooting, where the teacher in the film is actually from, he's from the village of Barine, illegal settlers had descended and started torching the olive groves. And that's something that actually takes place in the film as well. And so we get word that that's happening at the same time. And it's there's a pressure of really trying to do justice to that injustice that is taking place around you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's many more stories I could tell you, but I know our time is limited. And so it was really trying to get to the finish line, staying positive, leading a team, making a film that is a deeply human story centered on specific characters, but set in this very harsh reality. It was pretty overwhelming. I'd say it's the hardest thing I've ever had to do.
The fact that you've completed it and it's now available for people to watch is amazing. And do you think the choice of choosing to film in Palestine, along with all of the challenges that took place, do you think that will have a broader impact on the audience as a whole?
Oh, I think I definitely think so. First of all, I've just got loads of like stories anyway to tell, which is helpful in the sense of like people are always intrigued, like how did you manage this, from a sort of marketing point of view, if you like. But the film itself, you can breathe in the film. When you watch the film, the topography, for example, we've got these beautiful wide shots where you see the landscapes, the beautiful and the ugly. You had incredible performances from Palestinians. Yes, they could have been brought outside, some of them, not all of them. But you also have that sort of impact and love of all the people who worked on the film that really permeates in the film. Mm-hmm. Because it's not just a job for everybody who worked on this film. It's their life. And you feel that. You feel that in the performances. You feel that from the entire project, to be honest. And I think audiences have been feeling that in the UAE, for sure. We've had such an incredible reaction. So I do think so.
Well, the Palestinian case has been brought to light only recently, of course, you know, or I would say recognized by Western people. So do you think that your movie, you directed it in a way that I would say is portrayed effectively to the Western society and the Western world?
Do you know, I think for me, I've always had my foot in, you know, one foot in the West, one foot in the Arab world as a Palestinian. And so I think I just naturally, I follow my creativity, and I'd like to say I have the best of both worlds in many ways. And so that by default, I've written and directed a film that I say kind of almost appeals to me as somebody who is multicultural, but at the same time, yes, I am very accustomed to and have grown up on, you know, Western films in many ways. And but also just telling a story that I think is really representative of what you know, that place on Earth, and its beauty, and there's humor in it, and there's sort of cultural elements in it. There's multicultural characters in it. Again, just because I think that that is, you know, what I've seen and witnessed there. I've met people like Lisa, the British volunteer, played by Imogen Poots. I've had, you know, I've witnessed so much of what's going on in the film. It's inspired by true events. So I don't know, but I think it does have an appeal that's more broad, but just by default, yeah.
So now it's released and it's being shown also in Alistair Cal Avenue, and which Cinema Keel is a, you know, strong advocate for a Palestinian cause. How does that feel, and where can people also watch it, you know?
Yeah. So we had our world premiere at Toronto International Film Festival, and we had our MENA premiere in Jeddah in the Red Sea International Film Festival. And well, I'll plug that we took home the Best Actor Award and the Main Jury Award, so that was great.
Amazing.
And then we had a sort of, yeah, the cinema-wide release in across the GCC, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Kuwait, February 8th. And you can still see it in the UAE across select cinemas, including Cinema Akil, Vox, Roxy. And we will be having cinema-wide releases in the region further, Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, that's coming up. We have our UK premiere at Glasgow Film Festival in early March, super excited about that. And then it'll be going to more and more festivals, including in Norway, Switzerland, the States, in the States. We'll have a cinema-wide release coming up in Italy, and hopefully, you know, wider releases everywhere, all over the world. But it's a process. Mm-hmm. And hopefully eventually on streamers and online, and so, yeah.
Netflix.
That's amazing. So you have made the film, and of course it has raised a lot of awareness, or I would say sheds light to people who do not know what happens in Palestine, or mm-hmm. like, you know, the Palestinian occupation in general, right? Mm-hmm. So the film is out. But do you have any other plans to as well continue telling a story of what's happening in Palestine, mm. specifically that right now we are at a very, I would say,
crucial juncture.
Exactly.
I'd say, yes. Very, very crucial juncture in the discourse on Palestine. You know, so this, I'm writing something that has, you know, is related to Palestine, it's related to identity and what one would be willing to risk to pursue one's dreams. I'm also writing something that has absolutely nothing to do with Palestine. But this film really does arrive at this very crucial juncture in the discourse. And so, like I said, it is centered around specific characters, it's a deeply human story, but it does provide, and I'd like to think it does provide, even though that, you know, that's not the main thing that I had wanted in terms of as an artist, as a filmmaker, you know, you set out to take audiences on an emotional journey. And for me, I wanted audiences to really contemplate these characters and their experiences and the decisions and choices they make and this sort of cruel reality in which they're forced to make them. But this was written and shot far beyond, you know, the last few months and, mm-hmm. and what's you know, the cruelty, the massacre that's taking place in Gaza right now. But I'd like to think, and I hope, it does lend a very important context that is so often missing from the discourse on Palestine and what's currently happening. It's set in the West Bank, it was shot in the West Bank, not in Gaza, but this is a reality that Palestinians have been suffering for decades. And so I think that this film right now has so much to offer on that front, and it's kind of my offering in many ways, my solidarity, my active solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Palestine at the moment. I hope I can keep doing that. But again, it's always where your creativity takes you. It can't be contrived, and it has to originate, personally, I believe, from the heart. So I am writing something, but it's going to take time. And in the meanwhile, you know, we have the teacher.
Amazing. You've mentioned there that the movie sheds a light on the reality that Palestinians have faced for decades, not related to the crucial juncture we're looking at now. However, we spoke this morning about the UN Security Council vote where 13 out of 15 countries support ceasefire, two countries say no. So the topic, unfortunately, is divisive. Have you faced any backlash on the release of the movie?
No, I haven't. I think right now, actually, the film is being embraced more and more. I won't lie, there was a moment, after October 7th, where having worked 4 years on this film, I knew it was a difficult film regardless. I knew that a big, let's call it percentage of the film industry, film world, would not be interested in this film. Not audiences, I think actually vast, wide audiences are interested in this film prior to October 7th and since October 7th. However, there was a period where I think from a distribution point of view, from an industry point of view, there was a nervousness around my film because, you know, you've seen the trailer. There are some bizarre, I'm not a prophet, I didn't prophesy anything. This is inspired by true events from many years ago, because sadly, this has been going on for a very long time. It just happens to have arrived and been ready and released just a month before October 7th. So there was a sense of, oh, okay, the film is almost dead at birth, if you get my meaning. But actually, as the narrative has shifted, and it really has shifted because there's just no comparison, with what's happening in Gaza right now, I actually think there is an even wider interest and intrigue and audience for this film. And I really hope it does reach that audience, because I do think that while it is fiction, it is heavily rooted in truth, in reality, and it's very important for people to really have that context that's often missing.
Now that you've done the film, do you feel like you have a sense of responsibility to speak up more on Palestine?
I think the responsibility actually came when I was on the ground, in terms of really wanting to do the injustice justice in the film. Now that the film has been, you know, birthed or born and it's there, it's more a sense of pride and gratefulness. And I'm humbled in some ways as well, so pride and humbled, but in the sense that I could lend my artistic expression at this moment in time, and I have a feature-length cinematic film with some beautiful, stunning performances about an important subject matter that matters to me personally and to so many. At this moment in time, I think I feel kind of, I'd say proud and grateful that I have something to offer, because right now, so many of us are feeling, we're immersed in grief, and whether you're Palestinian or not Palestinian, what's taking place is almost beyond understanding. It's so difficult to process, and centering even how we feel is ridiculous when we think about what Palestinians are experiencing on the ground. So to be able to have that gives me a sense of, okay, this is my active engagement. This is something, and I'm. And yeah, there does come some responsibility. I agree. Yes, by default, I think. But I'm used to that. The present. It was a short film. It was very specific, and I carried a lot of, I guess, responsibility with that as well, but also pride.
That brings us to the end of our interview. Thank you so much for your time this morning, and thank you for shedding light on the injustice that's going on and that has continued to go on for decades in Palestine. We really appreciate your time this morning,
thank you.
Best of luck with the movie. It is out, as you said, in cinemas across the region.
Yes, now select cinemas, because it's been out since February 8th, but for another at least 9 days.
Let's keep it going, and let's get it onto the streaming platforms, which means we'll have access to it consistently.
And then I'll come back.
Farhan and Lucy, thank you so much for your time this morning. We really appreciate it, guys. That is all we have time for. We're back with you tomorrow morning, same time, same place. Goodbye from me.
Goodbye from me.
Bye-bye.